This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the most closely watched Senate races this year is in Pennsylvania, where the incumbent Republican, Arlen Specter, is being challenged by Democrat Lynn Yackel. My guest is Senator Specter. Ms. Yackel joined us earlier this month. The race is being watched in part because of what it might reveal about women's issues in politics. Senator Specter is being challenged by a woman at a time when there are few women in the Senate. But Specter is widely acknowledged as having a strong record on women's issues and has voted pro-choice. The Pennsylvania branch of the National Abortion Rights Action League, in an unusual move, endorsed both candidates. Another issue in this race is the lingering impact of the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearing on voters. Specter, a former district attorney in Philadelphia, was on the Senate Judiciary Committee and was the Republicans' chief questioner of Anita Hill. Senator Specter recently expressed disappointment in Justice Thomas's performance so far. I asked why Specter was disappointed in Thomas.
I said that some of his decisions were somewhat disappointing, such as the one where he did not find cruel and barbarous treatment where a prisoner with manacles was beaten. But I also said, and it wasn't covered in the wire reports, that 1 year is really too soon to make any finite judgment. And I thought back to William O. Douglas, who was the greatest civil libertarian perhaps in the history of the Supreme Court, who in his first year or two supported electronic surveillance. So I think that we have to wait and see, really, on Justice Thomas.
Do you have any regrets that you supported him?
I do not, because I think it is indispensable in America to have an African-American on the court. I think it was a national scandal that it took until Thurgood Marshall in 1967 to have the first African-American, and for that matter, really just wrong to wait until 1981 to have Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And when you see the problems in Los Angeles and problems that I used to see as District Attorney of Philadelphia, where I made it a point to have many African-Americans on my staff as assistant DAs or as district attorney detectives, in fact, had the first African-American chief of DA detectives, I think it's just indispensable. And really, it's not a question of whether Justice Thomas is the best nominee. I publicly disagreed with the president when he said he was the best person. I said that I didn't think so and named others, like Bill Coleman. And I also disagreed with the president when he said that race was not a factor. I think race was a factor and a very, very appropriate factor. But had Justice Thomas not been confirmed, the reports were that the person behind him was not African-American and even more conservative.
Your opponent, Lynn Yackel, has said that one of the reasons why she decided to enter the Senate race was her anger at how you questioned Anita Hill. I'm wondering if you think your role in the Clarence Thomas hearings and your method of questioning Anita Hill has affected your support in your reelection bid.
I don't think my opponent said that it was one of the reasons she entered the race. I think she said it was the reason she entered the race. That has been her single issue from the start right down until the present time. When others had chance to speak to the issues, when Congresswoman Boxer, for example, or former Mayor Feinstein or Ms. Braun from Illinois spoke at the Democratic National Convention, they talked about the problems facing their states and the nation. When my opponent spoke, all she talked was about the single issue. Do I think it's been a problem in the campaign? Yes, I do, but I think it has receded very materially as I have worked hard to get my message out that whatever anybody may think of my questioning of Professor Hill, no one can deny that there is not one of the other 99 senators who has a better record on women's issues than I do. I've been pro-choice. I've supported federal funding for women. I've been a leader, along with Senator Harkin, to bring additional funding for breast cancer. I've been, along with Senator Biden, a co-sponsor of his on the legislation to protect women against violence. When I was district attorney, I had special units on rape and sexual assault. So that I think that that problem is receding, but it's still there to an extent.
Well, you point out your strong record in supporting women's issues and in supporting the right to abortion. When Clarence Thomas was chosen as the nominee for Supreme Court Justice, I think everyone in the country had a sense that one of the reasons why he was chosen was because he was likely to vote against abortion, even though he didn't come out and give his stand on abortion during the hearings. But it was widely felt that that's how he would vote. And I'm wondering if that troubled you at all, as someone who has supported the right to choose over the years.
Well, I do not think you can select a Supreme Court nominee based on a single issue. And that's just not my personal view. That's really the attitude of the whole Senate. And let me tell you why it's really demonstrable. If you take Senator Barbara Mikulski from Maryland, no one could doubt her credentials on choice. She voted for Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was widely believed to be anti-choice or pro-life. Anthony Kennedy was confirmed 99-0. When Scalia was up, everybody knew he was pro-life. That was plain. And he was confirmed 99-0. Ted Kennedy and Paul Simon and Howard Metzenbaum all voted for them. We just do not pick nominees based upon a single issue. That's just not the American way.
Many people felt that your line of questioning of Anita Hill wasn't designed to reveal the truth, but rather it was designed to discredit Anita Hill. What's your response to that?
My response is that the New York Times said my questioning was painstakingly polite. Nina Totenberg, your distinguished commentator on National Public Radio, one of the people who broke the story, said my questioning was entirely professional. Let me say this by way of addition. I don't really think that it serves a useful purpose to rehash the hearings. What I have found for myself personally is that it's been quite a learning experience. I had been district attorney of Philadelphia and had had some substantial experience with sexual harassment, but I didn't know how widespread it was until really after those hearings, and it sort of came into sharp focus when a friend of mine, a woman in her late 40s, early 50s, said to me that she had been sexually harassed. And she said to me, "Arlen, when you were questioning Professor Hill, I almost felt as if you didn't believe me, and it was very painful for me," she said. And I told her very spontaneously that it made me feel bad to hear that I certainly had not intended to cause her any anguish or pain, and that what I was trying to do was to find out what happened between one man and one woman in one specific circumstance. And I do think now, and frankly thought then, that we went too fast. On Sunday afternoon, when we got together to decide whether we would observe the one-week limit that the full Senate had instructed us to do, to come back so they could vote again on Tuesday, in the closed session, I disagreed, and then I disagreed on national television. I said I thought we should take longer. Listen, there were 14 men and one woman. It wasn't a good visual. 14 white men and one African-American woman. And when there were other women who wanted to come forward to give us their views, I thought we should have taken more time and said so. We were really trying to figure out why she moved with him from the Department of Education to EEOC, why she called him, why she drove him to the airport, had social contacts, and other people wanted to testify about how a woman in her position might respond. But it has been quite a learning experience, and I think that although painful, in many ways America has benefited. I think that workplace conduct has changed, and a lot of people are a lot more sensitive about that issue today than they were a year ago.
You were saying that you were trying to understand why Anita Hill would keep up contact with Clarence Thomas if he, in fact, had said the things that she had accused him of saying. Now, Clarence Thomas was already a very influential man who could have helped or hurt Anita Hill professionally. As a politician yourself, as someone whose career depends on political expediency and cutting deals and forging alliances with people you don't necessarily like personally, why was that so hard to understand?
Well, I do not agree with your statement that I operate on political expediency or cut deals.
Well, I wasn't accusing you personally. I mean, I just think all politicians have to operate by certain political rules of the game.
Let me say this. I think there's a lot more to the Senate race than Professor Hill and Justice Thomas. And I have commented on it extensively, but my preference and I've tried to do this with my opponent in this political race without much success, is to talk about the economy, putting 10 million Americans back to work, or talk about affordable health care for all Americans, or education reform, crime control, environmental protection. I think those are the real issues that face Pennsylvania and America. And when we spend all the time on Professor Hill, I'm glad to talk about it, and I already have extensively, but I'd like to talk about some of the real issues facing my state and the country.
Let me get back to the question, though. As someone who understands the way politics works, and that it's not necessarily, friendship or good feelings towards someone that help you forge an alliance or make a political deal together, why was it so hard to understand why Anita Hill would keep up professional contact with Clarence Thomas?
When I took into account everything that Professor Hill had said, and I tried to do it very fairly and very objectively, I just felt that on the weight of the evidence, it supported Justice Thomas. And I think the American people came to the same conclusion as reflected in the public opinion polls.
What do you think were the reasons that you were chosen to be the chief questioner of Hill during the hearings?
I think I was asked to take on that role because I have such a strong record on women's issues, because I had led the fight against Judge Bork. I opposed Judge Bork because I thought he was the most extreme nominee ever to have been submitted for the court, and the people who didn't like my conclusion on Justice Thomas were delighted with it on Judge Bork, and I think that it was thought by those who asked me to take on the questioning that my record with women and my ability as a questioner and my prior record in being very independent from the administration gave me good credentials for the job.
Did you discuss your role with anyone in the administration?
I did not discuss my role with anybody in the Bush administration.
You've called your questioning of Anita Hill legally correct but politically unwise. Would you have done it differently if you could do it again today?
Oh, I think with what I've learned that the sensitivities would be more profound and there would be some changes. But let me just say this. We're over half of the time on this interview, and you ask the questions and I give the answers, and I know that you're privileged to play all this. But when we have problems of the economy and health care and environmental protection and crime control and foreign policy, those are some of the things which I think ought to be discussed on a program for the Senate race in 1992 without spending more than half of the time on one hearing. Whatever anybody may think of my questioning of that hearing, there is no doubt that my record on women's issues is very, very strong. No one in the Senate, among the other 99 senators, has a better record. And there are a lot of other issues.
You accused Anita Hill of perjury during the hearings. Do you stand by that?
The record in the congressional record is detailed on the reasons that I set forth then, and that's what I have to say about the subject.
My guest is Senator Arlen Specter, who is running for re-election in Pennsylvania. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Senator Arlen Specter is my guest. And let's talk about the economy. I wonder if you support either the president's or Governor Clinton's economic proposals to turn around the economy. Or if you have a different vision of your own that you would put forward.
The economic proposals that I have favored were taken on the common points from what the president sent to the Congress and what the Congress sent back to the president. When the president made his State of the Union speech and sent over a 7-point proposal, it got very short shrift in the Congress. And then the Congress sent back its own economic recovery program, Congress controlled by the Democrats, and candidly, it got equally short shrift in the White House. Senator Domenici and I took a look at both programs and found that there were 4 points in common. And many months ago, in April, we introduced legislation to urge that we act on those 4 points, an investment tax credit for first-time home buyers to give young people a chance to buy houses and to stimulate the building industry, an investment tax allowance to stimulate manufacturing, bringing back passive losses on real estate to separate out genuine real estate transactions from tax shams, and fourth, to have broader rules for investment of pensions. And we've tried very hard to get that adopted since it was in both proposals, and I'm still trying to do that. I advocated one other idea last November when I took a look at the budget deal and found that the government cannot spend any money to prime the pump, so to speak, and noted that there was $800 billion fund from IRAs, individual retirement accounts and related accounts, and came forward with a proposal to utilize that money by having middle-income Americans be able to withdraw up to $10,000 without penalty or tax for use on big-ticket items like homes, college, medical expenses, or a new car. And it was estimated that that would put some $40 billion into the economy by Chairman Greenspan. But I think the government can do quite a lot to stimulate the economy. I think we should have acted before now, and as we speak, we're taking up a tax bill on the Senate floor, which could stimulate the economy better late than never.
You started off your political career as a Democrat and switched to the Republican Party, and I believe it was 1965 when you couldn't run as a Democrat for district attorney in Philadelphia. You've become one of the Republicans who most often votes against the president. Are you comfortable as a Republican?
I am comfortable as a Republican. I did run on the Republican ticket when I was a registered Democrat in Philadelphia in 1965. We had a very corrupt city administration. The Attorney General of the United States the year before had said that in Philadelphia nearly half the people were on the take. The chairman of the Democratic City Committee paid me a compliment. They were his words that they didn't want a young Tom Dewey in the DA's office. So I accepted the Republican nomination, did not change my registration, stayed a registered Democrat, and was the first person elected on the Republican ticket in many, many years, and then changed my registration because I wanted to try to bring back a two-party system in Philadelphia. A two-party system is great in our country, but it only works if there are two parties. And am I comfortable as a Republican? Yes, I am. I'm comfortable in the mold of Senator Javits as he outlines the Republican philosophy in his autobiography of a public man, comfortable with many of my colleagues, Bill Cohn, Jack Danforth, Jim Jeffords, John Chafee. There's a need for moderate Republicans in the party, and I feel comfortable here.
What have some of your greatest frustrations been in the Senate since 1980 in trying to fight for things that your state, Pennsylvania, needs? And Pennsylvania is one of the states that was hard hit by the move from an industrial base to what's been described as a service economy. But a Pennsylvania state that's really suffered during the period of industrial decline.
I have been most frustrated by being unable to get the President and the Congress to agree on a compromise economic recovery package this year when there were 4 points in common, which I referred to before from the President's package and the Congressional package. And I took that directly to the President and directly to the Senate Majority Leader, and I couldn't bring the parties together. That's very frustrating because I think if we'd passed that package in the spring, we'd be on our way to an economic recovery now. I'm very frustrated by not being able to bring health care to the floor. As I specified before, I tried to bring it to the floor through an amendment in July and was stymied by the majority leader. When you talk about Pennsylvania, I feel pretty good about what we've been able to do there. We've kept the Navy Yard open, won an historic case where I argued it personally in court for the Philadelphia Navy Yard. We have brought considerable funding to Western Pennsylvania for high tech, the Department of Defense Software Center. Have a great new airport out there. I've gotten money to update the locks and dams. I've been in every one of Pennsylvania's 67 counties, and through my seniority and place on the Appropriations Committee, have brought a lot of federal help to Pennsylvania.
Did you go to the Republican convention?
Absolutely.
And what were your impressions of it?
Well, I was sorry that we were unable to muster the six states to challenge the platform on abortion. I don't think that abortion has any place in a political platform, just like I don't think government should control abortion. I was not pleased with Pat Buchanan's speech. I didn't like the points that Reverend Robertson made, but there were other aspects that were good. I think Governor Weld of Massachusetts spoke well in articulating a stand in favor of right to choose, in favor of choice. I thought that Mary Fisher, who was a victim of AIDS, spoke eloquently about the need for the party to assist people who are afflicted with AIDS. Yeah, the convention had a lot of good and bad in it, sort of like the Democratic convention when they wouldn't let Governor Casey speak on his own views, even though he's the governor of a big state.
Senator, you've made it very clear to me during this interview that you feel you shouldn't be asked a lot about the Clarence Thomas hearings during the course of the interview, and I'd like to know really why not, for this reason. The American public got to see more of you during those hearings than perhaps they saw of you at any other time, because they were nationally televised and because it became such a national event. And most people felt very strongly about your performance one way or another. Why at re-election time isn't it a good time to really hear from you why you did what you did?
Oh, I'm delighted to talk about the Justice Thomas hearings, and I have spent considerable time. But it sounds like the repertoire of my opponent. There's just a lot more to this race than a single issue. We haven't had a chance to talk about education, break the mold schools. We haven't had a chance to talk about the tremendous problems facing the environment. We haven't had a chance to talk about the foreign policy with the Soviet Union or the important issues of the Mideast. And when the campaign comes back again and again and again to the single issue, as I speak to America on national public radio, I just think there's a lot more that faces this country.
Arlen Specter is a Republican senator from Pennsylvania who is running for re-election. His opponent, Lynn Yackel, joined us earlier this month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.